Thank you for your interest in Hunt & Williams series, Hunt & Global Privacy Update. I'm Bridget Tracy, a partner in the firm's London office, and I lead our privacy and cybersecurity practice in the UK. As a reminder, we hold these updates every 2 months, and they're formatted to provide informative updates on the latest issues in global privacy and data protection. They're usually limited to 30 minutes in length, and the on-demand recording is posted on our privacy blog at www.huntandprivacyblog.com. Today we'll cover a number of topics in data protection and privacy, including the recent judgment in the Costea case. We'll look at the Centre's recent work on developing a risk-based approach to privacy. We'll consider US government access to personal data, the Canadian anti-spam legislation, and further EU developments. Due to the number of topics, this session will run slightly longer than 30 minutes. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce our practice to you. We're located throughout the US, Europe, and Asia, and we assist clients all over the world. We're recognized as privacy leaders globally. For more information, visit our blog mentioned earlier, www.huntandprivacyblog.com, and our EU data protection regulation tracker at www.huntandregulationtracker.com. Turning to our program, the European Court of Justice's recent judgment in the Costea case has drawn much interest. I'm going to begin the program by briefly discussing the case and outlining some of its implications. We've all heard of the decision of the Court of Justice of the European Union concerning Google Spain and Mr. Costea, who enlisted the Spanish DPA's help in removing certain links from Google's search results. The links relate to an announcement of a real estate auction for the recovery of Mr. Costea's debts. The information was lawfully published in 1998, but Mr. Costea argued that the information had become irrelevant because the proceedings against him had been resolved. The Spanish DPA upheld the complaint and ordered the removal of the links. Google appealed that decision to the High Court in Spain, which then referred a series of questions to the Court of Justice of the European Union for a preliminary ruling. The court ruling contained several key findings. And of course, media focus has been on the so-called right to be forgotten and the implications for the decision on freedom of speech. But the court's findings on applicable law are very, very significant and deserve close scrutiny by non-European companies targeting their business and data processing activities at the EU. Looking at the applicable law findings, the court determined that the actions of search engine operators in automatically collecting information from the internet, storing and indexing that information, and displaying the information in search results constitutes the processing of personal data within the meaning of the EU Data Protection Directive. This finding underscores the breadth of the EU definition of processing. Next, the court decided that a search engine operator is a data controller within the meaning of the directive with respect to such processing. Further, where a search engine operator located outside the EU has subsidiaries in one or more EU member states, and those subsidiaries promote and sell advertising space offered by the search engine, and the search engine directs its activities towards the inhabitants of the member states, for example, by providing a website with a local top-level domain and local language customization, then the search engine operator is treated as being established in those member states within the meaning of Article 4 of the directive. So the court considered that although Google Inc. is a company registered in California, that it is a data controller with respect to its search services and is established in Spain in the context of the activities of Google Spain because Google Spain promotes and sells advertising services that are integrated into the Google search results and the advertising is served on Google's Spanish website. This is perhaps the most important aspect of the Google Spain decision. And as I've said, it has implications for many other non-European businesses with European subsidiaries. Non-EU companies with operations in Europe who have until now considered their non-European entities to be outside the scope of European data protection law really need to review their position in light of COSTEA. And I would also just comment that in any event, the COSTEA finding on applicable law appears to be consistent with the general direction of travel on this issue under the proposed regulation. This is not an issue that's going to disappear. Then turning to the aspects of the case that have really attracted the most comment, the European Court appears to have also anticipated the proposed regulation in their findings on the so-called right to be forgotten. The court held that at the request of an individual, a search engine operator is required to consider whether information that relates to that individual personally should no longer be displayed in the results of a search made on the basis of the individual's name, particularly if the information is inadequate, irrelevant, or excessive in relation to the purposes for which the information is processed. In making this this assessment, there also needs to be consideration of all the circumstances, including the individual's rights under the Charter of Fundamental Rights, so Article 7, respect for private and family life, and Article 8, protection of personal data. If the information is indeed inadequate, irrelevant, or excessive, then the search engine operator is obliged to remove the links, even when the original publication of the information was lawful, unless there is an overriding public interest in favour of access. So since that decision, Google has provided a means for requests for removal to be made, and they've started taking down links. In the decision itself, the court gave little practical guidance on how the removal request process should operate. And already it's apparent that the expectations of individuals, data protection authorities, and the media across Europe as to how the balancing test should apply are very different. In the UK, just last week, a leading BBC journalist was outraged when one of his blog postings was removed in order to satisfy a takedown request from an individual who'd commented on the blog post. So the ruling in COSTEA has resulted in a great deal of uncertainty and frustration. And shortly after the judgment, in a typically insightful way, the UK Deputy Information Commissioner David Smith noted that the judgment might mark the end of a lengthy legal process, but that it marked merely the beginning of determining what the practical implication of the decision would be. This is an issue, a set of issues that we will see debated and discussed for some time to come. This year, the Centre for Information Policy Leadership launched a project to explore how we might develop a risk-based approach to data privacy regulation. Centre President Boyana Bellamy will share with us the recent findings of the Centre's project.
Hello. I would like to share some thoughts with you on the latest developments and thinking about risk-based approach to privacy and privacy risk framework. As many of you have heard, risk has been called the new black. UK Information Commissioner Christopher Graham calls it the R word and warns that many people have different expectations and give different meanings to this word as well. There has been this renewed discussion and focus globally on risk-based approach and really the need to develop privacy risk framework and methodology that can be used by organizations and data privacy authorities too. But what do we mean by risk-based approach? In short, it's all about calibrating action, calibrating compliance, and shaping your privacy program based on risk. And that risk is actually a risk to individuals, privacy risks to individuals rather than only risks to organizations. As many of you know, the Center for Information Policy Leadership has been following this topic and launched the project in January this year to explore what is meant by risk-based approach, to build a consensus specifically with regulators about what privacy harms and risks really are, how to identify them, how to evaluate, how to address them in a user-friendly and viable privacy risk framework. and also to explore the potential for the risk-based approach to be used more widely by organizations, by privacy regulators and policy and lawmakers. We held a successful workshop in Paris at the end of March and published a post-Paris paper just now in June, which is available on the website. And I do encourage you to have a look at that paper, because it goes into much more detail than I can do today. But why are we focusing on risk-based approach today? Three main reasons. First of all, it is a requirement of accountability, and accountability is a growing expectation for privacy management programs really around the world. And that is the expectation that organizations will have corporate privacy programs and will be conducting risk assessments at programmatic and at micro level, at product, service, technology, system, initiative level as well, to assess the risks to individuals of any initiative that they do. Second reason why this approach is gaining momentum is that this is increasingly legal requirement. You only have to read the legitimate interest opinion by Article 29 that interprets the current law, and also look at the proposed European Data Protection Regulation to see that there are many elements of risk that are enshrined in this new proposal: privacy by design, data security measures, breach notification, privacy impact assessments. In the US as well, risk-based approach has been picked up by FTC in its unfairness doctrine, but also in security breach notification laws around the US states and elsewhere in the world. This is becoming an increasing legal requirement. But finally, and perhaps most importantly, in my opinion, I really think that the reason why we should be focusing on risk-based approach is because it would be a useful tool to calibrate the application of privacy principles in the modern information age. It will help prioritize for organizations and DPAs the action that they need to take. It will also help us ensure effective compliance on the ground for individuals. Organizations seek predictability. They seek assurances that their privacy programs are effective, and regulators want to achieve the same. So there is this joint interest in actually helping prioritize and helping use innovative tools like risk-based approach. Now, I do want to stress, and this is important, that risk-based approach should not be a substitute for existing legal framework and accountability, but it just turns the dial. It actually helps implement and helps give concrete action on the ground to these big privacy principles, or even privacy as a fundamental human right from European perspective as well. I have mentioned that there have been a number of developments around the world in the past months where this whole topic has gained momentum. I've mentioned the data protection regulation proposed in Europe, but Podesta report on big data talks about a risk-based approach. And of course, the Article 29 has just published in June a statement on risk-based approach. I encourage you to look at that. Article 29 recognizes the focus on this topic, and again reminds us that, in fact, this is becoming an increasing legal requirement as well. But also, the Article 29 warns against using risk-based approach to diminish individual rights or data protection principles. It does allow, however, for calibration of compliance and accountability based on risk. It also warns about adopting a strictly use-based model for privacy protection, and Article 29 says that privacy protection and risk should actually be applied in the whole life cycle of information, from collection to its use, to its sharing, transfer, and of course ultimately destruction. And that is also what the center has advocated in its paper as well. And finally, interestingly, Article 29 mentions what the data privacy authority's role will be in respect to the risk-based approach. And in particular, they do say that targeting compliance action and enforcement activities will be done based on areas of greatest risk, which to me is quite promising. I hope you found this useful. Do not hesitate to contact me if you have any questions about the Centre project further. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Bojana. Please visit the Centre's website at www.informationpolicyleadership.com for more information about this project and about the Centre. And now I'm going to turn to U.S. partner Paul Tiao, who will discuss the latest on U.S. government access to personal data.
Thank you, Bridget. Earlier this month, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board issued a lengthy report on legal and policy issues associated with the NSA Prism program, a program that was leaked to the press by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. I'm going to talk briefly about this report in the context of an overview of major developments since The Guardian and The Washington Post first began publishing articles based on information provided to them by Mr. Snowden. As you may recall, thanks to Mr. Snowden, in June of last year, we first learned about two major U.S. government electronic surveillance programs. One concerned the NSA collection of telephone call records or metadata for the domestic calls of most Americans on an ongoing basis pursuant to Section 215 of the Patriot Act. This program was reviewed and authorized by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court in 2006 and has been the subject of regular renewed approvals ever since. The second program concerned the NSA's collection of phone calls, emails, chat, and other online communications content, where the targets are reasonably believed to be non-U.S. persons located outside of the U.S. Known as PRISM, this program's roots began in President Bush's terrorist surveillance program shortly after the September 11, 2001 attacks. Following disclosures of the program in 2005, controversy ensued. The government later developed a statutory framework, the FISA Amendments Act, specifically designed to authorize this collection program. Lawsuits challenging the legality of the programs, as well as calls for policy reform, immediately followed their disclosures. Thus far, the courts are divided. In December of last year, a district court in New York upheld the legality of the Section 215 program. In Washington, D.C., however, another district court held that the program was unconstitutional. Both cases are pending on appeal. In response to calls for surveillance reform, President Obama announced several policy changes in January. They include, for example, reforms that would preserve the capabilities of the current program, but do so without the government holding the bulk metadata. The declassification of Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court opinions that have broad privacy implications, and a call to Congress to authorize the establishment of a panel of privacy advocates from outside the government to argue significant cases before the FISC, and changes that would allow communications providers to make more public information about electronic surveillance orders that have been received from the government. The president also convened an independent commission to review the two programs and other aspects of U.S. surveillance. In December, the commission called for 46 reforms, including ending the bulk data collection program, additional restraints on the PRISM program, and the establishment of public privacy advocates who would argue before the FISC. In addition, the president and Congress requested that the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board review both programs. The board is an independent bipartisan agency within the executive branch that was established in 2007. In January, the board issued a report on the bulk metadata collection program, concluding that it did not comport with Section 215 or the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and that it raised serious concerns under the Constitution. The report recommended termination of the program and called for increased transparency in the government surveillance activities and reforms to the FISC that were consistent with those outlined by the independent commission. Earlier this month, the board issued its report on the PRISM program. Here, it found that the program comported with the law. However, it raised concerns about certain aspects of collection and recommended changes designed to protect privacy, increase transparency, and strengthen judicial oversight. Nonprofit privacy advocates have expressed disappointment that the board did not adopt a more aggressive stance in this report. Not to be left behind, Congress, with support from the technology industry and privacy community, has introduced a number of bills that are designed to curb excessive surveillance. For example, these bills would end bulk metadata collection, prevent NSA interference with encryption methods, require a warrant before searching a government database for information about U.S. persons, prevent agencies from directing companies to alter services to enable surveillance of their customers, and allow companies to disclose greater detail about government surveillance requests. Meanwhile, the tech industry is taking matters into its own hands by increasing the use of encryption in email, chat, search queries, and other online traffic, and opposing the federal government's demands for non-U.S. citizen data held by U.S. companies and servers located overseas. This area will be a hotbed of activity in the future, so please stay tuned. And back to you, Bridget.
Next, my partner Wim Nowalert, based in Brussels, will provide an update on the latest concerning the EU data protection regulation. Wim.
Thank you, Bridget. There really isn't much to report on the general data protection regulation at this point. The regulation is still not adopted, but the negotiations appear to be in an advanced stage. As I'm sure you know, last May, the EU citizens elected a new European Parliament, and this took the attention away from the fact that the EU member states gathered in the European Council were quite busy reviewing the General Data Protection Regulation and were trying to find common ground on a number of thorny issues. And so in the beginning of last month, the Justice Council, which gathered in Luxembourg, moved from dormant to dynamic negotiations on the data protection reform, at least according to Commissioner Reding. The Council reportedly agreed on two very important pillars of the data protection reform. First, there was an agreement on the rules that govern data transfers to countries outside the EU, which is Chapter 5 of the regulation. And the regulation sets out three avenues which can be used to make legal transfers. First of all, adequacy decisions. So where the European Commission has found that a non-EU country is adequate in terms of data protection. And this means that certain conditions set out in the law, like, for example, having robust data protection legislation or data protection authority in place, are met. Secondly, appropriate contractual safeguards, including, for example, binding corporate rules approved by the data protection authorities. And thirdly, in clearly defined specific situations which necessitate a transfer of personal data, for example, in the context of a tax or competition investigation. So there is agreement within the Council that these three avenues allow for secure data transfers. And in light of the Snowden revelations and the debate about safe harbor, this is considered an important signal. The EU ministers also agreed on the territorial scope of the General Data Protection Regulation. So under the General Data Protection Regulation, EU data protection law will apply to non-European companies if they do business on EU territory. This was one of the most contentious points early in the debate, and it's important that apparently now this principle has been cemented into stone, well, in fact, in Article 3 of the General Data Protection Regulation. And finally, the Council also discussed once more the one-stop-shop principle. According to this principle, there should be one decision by one single data protection authority when it comes to cross-border services involving data processing. The basic idea is to cut red tape for companies and citizens and to make sure data protection rules are applied consistently throughout the EU. And if we can believe Commissioner Reding, positions are now coming closer to the model for such a system, with the general understanding that there should be a lead authority that works closely with other data protection authorities, and in particular, the data protection authority with which citizens have lodged a complaint. And this is to address the so-called proximity concern that has been expressed by a number of EU member states in the past. On June 26 and 27th, the European Council met again and issued an, in my opinion, rather vague statement saying that it will be crucial to ensure the protection and promotion of fundamental rights, including data protection, while addressing security concerns, also in relation with third countries, and to adopt a strong EU General Data Protection Framework by 2015. But the European Data Protection Supervisor, DDPS, apparently saw this as a clear commitment made by the European Council to ensure the protection and promotion of fundamental rights, including data protection, over the next few years. And in a recent letter to Herman Van Rompuy, who is the president of the European Council, the EDP has also emphasized the importance of data protection, not only in the area of freedom, security and justice, but also for the EU's wider agenda for growth and investment in the digital economy. So in short, it looks like the data protection reform is on track, and that considerable progress has been made on the alignment of different positions within the European Council. But we're not quite there yet. There will probably be more news on this front after the summer break. And with this, I turn it back to you, Bridget.
And now we're going to hear from Chris Heideck, who will discuss the Canadian anti-spam legislation that came into effect on the 1st of July.
Thank you, Bridget. My name is Chris Heideck, and I'm an associate in the New York office of Hunt & Williams. I'm going to talk a little bit about Canada's new anti-spam law, CASEL. CASEL was passed in December of 2010, but the majority of the provisions did not come into effect until July of this year. The provisions that came into effect deal with sending commercial electronic messages, or CEMs, to individuals. Other provisions will come into effect in January of 2015 that cover installing computer programs on individuals' computers. The last provisions to come into effect will be the private right of action that CASEL grants aggrieved customers, which will come into effect in July of 2017. CASEL prohibits sending CEMs to individuals without their consent, with limited exceptions. A message is a CEM if it is of a commercial character, regardless of the expectation of profit. CASEL applies to messages sent into or out of Canada. However, regulations issued in December of 2013 limit CASEL's application to messages sent from Canada to consumers in other countries. The regulations contain a list of over 100 countries, and if the recipient is in one of these countries, CASEL does not apply as long as the message complies with the similar applicable anti-spam law. The United States is on this list. So if a Canadian business sends a CEM to a consumer in the United States, as long as the CEM is compliant with CAN-SPAM, CASEL would not apply. So CASEL requires express or implied consent to send a CEM to a consumer. If a business wants to, with limited exceptions, if a business wants to obtain express consent, the purpose in its request for consent, the purpose must be simple and clear. Boxes cannot be pre-checked, and the request for consent cannot be bundled with other terms and conditions. The business must include a statement that the individual can withdraw consent, and the person seeking consent must be clearly identified. Implied consent is also a sufficient mechanism basis for sending CEMs. Implied consent can arise in a variety of ways, including if an individual has recently purchased a product from the business. The main difference between express consent and implied consent is that implied consent expires. If a business obtains express consent to send CEMs to an individual, it can send them in perpetuity until the individual requests that they no longer receive CEMs. With implied consent, there's expiration dates. So, for example, if an individual purchases a product, the business can send the individual CEMs for 2 years after the purchase. But if the business has not obtained express consent during those 2 years, or another basis has arisen during those 2 years to send CEMs to the individual, the business must quit 2 years after the date of the purchase. There are various exceptions under CASEL that allow businesses to send CEMs without consent at all, including transaction confirmations, warranty recall, safety information, and various other exceptions. CASEL contains severe penalties. The maximum fine for individuals is $1 million, Canadian dollars. The maximum fine for businesses is $10 million, Canadian dollars. Also, beginning in July of 2017, there is a private right of action, which is up to $200 per message and a maximum of $1 million Canadian dollars per day. CASEL is enforced by three different Canadian agencies, including the Canada Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission. CASEL does include a transitional period, which began on July 1st of this year and will continue until July 1st of 2017. The transitional period loosens the requirements around implied consent. For example, the expiration dates during this transition period do not apply. Businesses should take note of CASEL, especially due to the harsh penalties and the upcoming private right of action that will begin in 2017. And now back to you, Bridget.
Finally, and our last piece today, our practice chair, Lisa Soto, will discuss Hunton & Williams' report, authored in collaboration with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Business Without Borders, The Importance of Cross-Border Data Transfers to Global Prosperity. The report highlights the benefits of cross-border data transfers in the international marketplace, and it was introduced in Brussels just last week. Lisa, over to you.
Thank you, Bridget. Several months ago, Hunton & Williams was tapped by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to draft a white paper on cross-border data transfer issues. The intention was to focus on legal obstacles that confront multinationals whose business depends on having seamless access to data worldwide. Our New York and London offices worked together with the Chamber of Commerce to research and develop the report, which explores a broad range of topics, including, first, the benefits of cross-border data transfers, second, how restrictions on data flows negatively affect the global economy, and third, possible opportunities for new data transfer regimes. The end result of our efforts is a 40-page paper entitled Business Without Borders, The Importance of Cross-Border Data Transfers to Global Prosperity. Hunton & Williams released the report jointly with the Chamber in Washington, D.C. on May 12th, in Jakarta later in May, and just last week in Brussels. The report underscores the importance of developing data transfer mechanisms that protect privacy and facilitate the free flow of data. The paper fleshes out many of the key data transfer-related issues our multinational clients need to consider to operate globally. As we all know, to function in the global marketplace, companies have to have the ability to move huge amounts of data seamlessly across jurisdictions. Unfortunately, as we noted in the report, many of the legal frameworks currently in place were developed before the information age gave rise to today's ubiquitous electronic data flows, and so they were not crafted to address the ways in which data moves and is used today. These restrictions are outdated, and they're ill-suited to respond to the evolving technologies of today, and they threaten to hobble global economic growth. But despite the myriad advantages of allowing data to flow freely between countries, some governments, of course, continue to encourage restrictions on cross-border data transfers. As we discussed in the report, certain restrictions that we've seen cropping up lately, like data localization requirements, seem to be protectionist in nature. Others are rooted in very valid concerns about data protection, but regardless of the motivation for imposing them, the restrictions create a strain on the economy and on business opportunities, and they end up depriving global consumers of the ability to obtain the highest quality goods and services at the best price. The report also notes that some of the more recent calls for increased data transfer restrictions can be traced to Snowden's revelations about government surveillance. Although concerns about government access to data are understandable, the proposed solutions fail to address the real issue. We highlight the fact that it makes no sense to impose restrictions on multinational businesses in an effort to curb government authorities' access to foreign personal data, given that the legal bases for government access to data don't apply to companies. To explore the real-world impact of cross-border data transfer restrictions on global organizations for purposes of the report, we surveyed high-profile global companies representing a variety of industry sectors, including consumer goods, healthcare, financial services, retail, telecom, manufacturing, and information technology. Our questions focused on how these organizations manage cross-border data flows and which data transfer mechanisms have proven most effective. The report includes case studies that illustrate what we learned during the course of our discussions, which is that companies use cross-border data transfers in a wide variety of ways and often are encumbered by the legal regimes that provide little or no protective benefit to data. The report discusses the limitations of the options currently available to companies to comply with such restrictions. For example, most of these laws permit cross-border data transfers if the company obtains the individual's consent. And most of the businesses we spoke with indicated that they rely on consent as a data transfer mechanism in at least some circumstances. But consent has a number of drawbacks. Often it has to be obtained in writing, which can be difficult, of course. The individual may revoke consent at any time, and consent must be obtained from each individual whose data will be transferred. Another mechanism, the Safe Harbor Framework, is widely used among the global companies we spoke with to transfer data to the United States. But as we indicated in the report, the framework has been the subject of a great deal of unwarranted pushback recently from critics who inappropriately conflate law enforcement access to data once the data are outside of the originating jurisdiction with the mechanism that was used to transfer the data outside that jurisdiction in the first place. As we're all painfully aware, the status of the safe harbor currently is in limbo. In light of the obvious need for seamless access to data located across the globe, the report provides suggestions for a path forward. We suggest greater reliance on accountability-based approaches, such as the APEC cross-border privacy rules, which we believe effectively protect privacy while offering pragmatic and flexible solutions to the problem of cross-border transfer restrictions. In the end, we believe that any truly workable solution has to require buy-in from a diverse group of stakeholders. So to this end, the report identifies some of the key concepts to help guide discussions going forward about how to approach cross-border data transfers. So some of the concepts are the following. First, we believe we need to recognize the fact that there are many different approaches to regulating cross-border transfers and that differing mechanisms can ensure a similar desired level of data protection. Second, we suggest moving away from rigid one-size-fits-all type regulations toward a more outcome-focused set of regimes. Third, we advocate for clear delineation between the issue of government access to data and the distinct issue of cross-border data transfers in a commercial context. Fourth, we need assurance that the frameworks we develop today are fit for tomorrow. And finally, we believe it's necessary to implement strong, binding trade agreement commitments that prohibit data localization requirements, that support unimpeded data flows, and that encourage interoperability among privacy regimes. If you'd like a copy of the report, you can download it from our blog at www.huntonprivacyblog.com. Back to you, Bridget.
Thank you for participating in our webcast. We look forward to having you again at our next program, scheduled for Tuesday, the 16th of September. Thanks very much.